This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on September 9th. Welcome to a special edition of Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin. I'm your host, Bob Daly, along with Michelle Manning Scott. We're in the middle of Co-op's fall membership drive. First and foremost, the message tonight is to go to our website, koop.org. Some of you are probably already there listening to us. There you'll find some buttons. One is labeled Donate, the other Become a Member Today. They both take you to the same place, and either one will allow you to express your support for Co-op, Austin's community radio station.
That's right, Bob. 100% of Co-op's programming is produced by volunteers. It has been our pleasure to stay with you, our listeners, throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. Our tech team has made it possible for us to continue production by pre-recording our shows at home.
So tonight's edition is unlike any other at Co-op. We do have volunteers handling the phones, so you can call 512-472-5667. We just won't be able to acknowledge your call on the air. Well, call anyway, 512-472-5667. Or if it's easier to remember, 512-472-KOOP. And of course, online at koop.org.
And we have some great gifts for y'all this time around. A couple of firsts. Due to the pandemic, of course, we've got a Co-op face mask. And that's for only $10 for a monthly sustainer contribution or a $60 one-time contribution. You'll get the face mask. But if you want the always coveted Co-op t-shirt, make it a $15 per month or $80 one-time donation, and you'll get both. And another first, for $25 per month or $125 one-time donation, you'll get a Co-op baseball cap plus the mask and the t-shirt.
So call now, 512-472-5667, or go to Co-op, koop.org. We couldn't do this without you. Our first guest this evening is Kim Jones, editor-in-chief of the Austin Chronicle, Austin's alt-weekly source for local politics, arts, and entertainment. From their website, the Austin Chronicle is an independent, locally owned and operated alternative newsweekly that reflects the heart and soul of Austin, Texas. Founded in 1981 and committed to a progressive point of view, the Chronicle addresses the community's political and environmental concerns, expresses Austin's rich cultural scene, and provides in-depth coverage of the capital city's live music and entertainment venues, performing arts centers, restaurants, recreational activities, and outdoor excursions. If it's important to Austin, it's in the Chronicle. And we'll be speaking with a few other members of the Chronicle staff later in the show, but first we'll start with Kim. How you doing, Kim?
I'm good, Bob. Thanks for having me on. It's really nice to be back on Co-op Radio. It's been too long.
It's just great to have you here. And it's been 6 months since I've seen you. It's been a kind of a wild ride. I mean, when I last saw you guys, you were just heading into a quarantine. Maybe you could just talk about that a little. I think you were exposed to someone in your office. Was that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's all a little surreal to think about now. I pulled up our issue archives on our website and looked at our old covers just to try to refresh my memory of what the last 6 months have been like. And it was pretty intense, you know, when obviously in March, when everything kind of started to fall apart. I think at the Chronicle, because we're the print sponsor of South by Southwest and we'd been tracking South by, the whole conversation was about, well, is South by going to get canceled? And that was kind of dominating everything. So I feel like we had a head start on really sweating COVID. Our March 20th issue, we started sending people home and devising plans. We had a skeleton crew. We got that issue out the door. I encourage people to look at our website. It's the issue that we have a little kitten on a rope and it says, hang in there.
Yeah.
Which, you know, was obviously a little tongue in cheek, but I think it was the right attitude that we wanted to put out in the world of just like brace for impact, but we're all in it together. And then literally I got home, we sent the paper to the printer at, you know, 7 o'clock. I got home. And within an hour, I found out that one of our coworkers had been diagnosed with COVID. And at the time, they were, I think, case number 32. And of course, now we've had 27,000 cases in Travis County. So, but at the time, it was surreal.
It was a big, big deal then, too. Like you said, you know, number 30, 32 compared to 27,000. My God.
Sure. And we immediately, you know, everybody who had been exposed to them went into quarantine for 2 weeks. And I wrote about it in the next week's column of just, you know, when they declared the stay-at-home orders, you know, we'd already been living that experience of just intense isolation. So, and in an isolation that we're all now pretty used to and getting pretty good at, which is weird to say too.
You know, I remember you using the term prickly panic. Because there were a number of times in subsequent months when, you know, I thought I was getting feverish or achy or I'd cough just one too many times. And I thought of that expression, the prickly panic.
Yeah, I think that first week I was probably checking my temperature about 12 times a day. I don't have a whole lot of experience with, you know, trauma and intense grief and sort of what, you know, the actual physical manifestation. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with this, sort of how your body reacts to stress and anxiety and tragedy. And I mean, it was a pretty intense time and it's, things have calmed down in some ways and in other ways, not so much. So.
Well, and that was just the beginning of your challenges. I mean, that point you wound up reducing the print issue to every other week, you were losing revenue and yet staffing concerns. Could you talk a little about that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we were facing the same issues as every other media outlet and especially, you know, small local papers. You know, we're an alternative weekly and we're part of an association of alternative weeklies, which are all progressive papers, came out of the 60s. Our group was maybe especially hit because so many of our advertisers are small businesses. You know, we're all in the same boat and we're all bailing water out as quickly as we can. But yes, my boss put into place immediately a plan that I think saved us, honestly. When we all went home, we switched to every other week for 6 weeks. We dropped our circulation and we had furloughs. We had reduced hours for almost our entire staff. We're about, 43 people, 44 people, something like that. We're a small business. And that 6 weeks was really hard because on top of everyone's personal stress over what was going on, yeah, we were dealing with smaller paychecks. We were dealing with having to rewrite every single one of our systems and figure out how to do everything digitally, which of course is what everybody has gone through. And it's been a real sink or swim kind of time. But we were really fortunate. We got the PPP loan came through. And after 6 weeks, we were able to go back to printing every week. So we've been on newsstands every week since then. And, you know, knock on wood, we're going to keep doing it for a lot more time to come. We just hit our 39th anniversary in print on September 4th. So that's a pretty big milestone and, you know, nice to have something to celebrate.
Yeah. Congratulations on that. That is a big deal, you know?
Yeah.
And, I'm hoping you're already planning for your big 40th next year.
Yeah, right. Oh man, it's kind of week to week right now, just trying to get to the next issue. So I'm sure we'll start talking about it soon.
Yeah, for sure. We can really resonate with having to adapt systems at co-op. This is being pre-recorded right now. all of our shows have been pre-recorded since mid-April. We were actually effectively off the air for 3 weeks when we did nothing but play music. But we've got this system by which we produce our shows at home and do all the editing and clean it up and everything. And then we drop it into a Google Drive for the station. And then every day somebody puts together the entire day's lineup. And it's all automated. I mean, every once in a while, something goes wrong and somebody's got to go in there and restart it. But it's worked remarkably well.
I'm so impressed with how you guys have been able to pull it together and get back on the air. And we've really missed doing our show at Co-op. And I think the feedback that we've gotten from our readers, and I feel confident that Co-op listeners feel the same, is that continuity really matters right now. And having the familiar voices and, you know, just be it a radio station or newspaper, sources that you can rely on, I think it's a really big deal. So I know I was thrilled when I started hearing familiar voices again on the radio.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, we certainly share your sentiments about that. You know, just thinking forward again, you know, so talking chronologically here about, you know, the initial quarantine and your challenges there at the newspaper, then in late April and into May, you know, all hell seemed to break loose on the news end of things. You know, locally here, we had the shooting of Michael Ramos. And then it was right around Memorial Day, I think, when George Floyd was killed. That set us in yet a whole other epoch of drama, if you will. How has that been for you guys on that end? I mean, you've seen some incredible events here in Austin that really are historic, and there you are on the front lines.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really challenging. I think even if there wasn't a pandemic going on, this would certainly be one of the most intense demands on our news department. There are so many important stories happening right now, and to throw the monkey wrench of an inability to be in an office together to discuss our plans, to have, you know, a limited budget to get freelancers on the ground. We have an incredibly small staff, which I don't think people necessarily always realize, that our news department is effectively three people. I was filing bylines for our news department this summer, and I am a former film critic. So I am definitely not qualified, but you know, I, like so many people, I am now watching the Austin Public Health press conferences every week and reporting on them. And it's a whole new world. I think, and I wrote about this a little bit in my column last week, sort of reflecting on our anniversary in the year. It is, I know a lot of people feel really lost right now. And I think that at the Chronicle, we are so grateful to have purpose right now. And I think that reporting on the news that's been happening, be it the COVID-19 or the ongoing protests, it's been a privilege. I think we serve a purpose. I think we offer a unique perspective than other media outlets in town, not to disparage what they do. I think it's a big ecosystem. We all have a place in it. And I think the Chronicle has been able to sort of prove what our place is. It's been a challenge for sure, but we're committed to reporting on the news as best we can and getting boots on the ground when it's safe. That's also been a challenge, and it's been an interesting summer in all of our departments, sort of figuring out what kind of reporting you do in person, what do you do over Zoom. You know, it's just, it's we're figuring everything out on the fly for sure.
Well, you know, Co-op, and especially this show, Civil Rights and Wrongs, has really benefited by the dedication of one of your staff members in particular. We've had Austin Sanders on doing quick updates, especially about the city council for mm-hmm. several weeks now. That's been, you know, yet another chapter in this 6 months, you know, of historic turn of events, you know. Reducing the budget of the Austin Police Department. I interviewed Greg Kassar a few weeks ago, and he tried to do that last year and got absolutely nowhere with it. And then this year they've got, you know, 11 people, the unanimous, mm-hmm. in initially cutting it 20 million and probably another 100 plus million after that when all the processes end and whatnot. So anyway, we've been very fortunate to have Austin join us, and we're extremely grateful, and we'll have him on a little later in the show here.
Yeah, Austin's been doing terrific reporting. He's our City Hall reporter. He's been covering Austin police, and I just think he's done a terrific job just sort of really like explaining to people what can get pretty, you know, just complicated stuff. Like you said, we're in an historic moment right now, and I think that there's a possibility for very real progressive change to happen in this town, and that's exciting, you know, and it's important to hold on to when things just feel really bad almost all of the time, and it has not been easy to get to this point, but I do think there's cause for cautious optimism. How about that?
Yeah, we'll go with that. Sure. And now time for a word about the fall membership drive here at Co-op.
Thanks, Bob. We want to take this quick break to remind you all that it is fall membership drive time here at Co-op. Please go to koop.org and find the donate button on the homepage, or call 512-472-5667 to make a donation over the phone. And even though our asks are the same as previous membership drives, we bet you can tell that this drive is unlike any other we've ever had. But that doesn't mean it's any less important. The fact is, this drive is even more important than others, simply because it is like no others we've ever had. Does that make sense? We've always relied on the generosity of our members to sustain us in the best of times. But this time, your support is even more crucial if you'd like Co-op to continue to stand up with this community and be a place to find the unique programming you can't get anywhere else in these not-so-great times. Please go to coop.org, find the donate button on the homepage, and give what you're able to. No amount of support is insignificant in these times. Or you can call 512-472-5667, and one of our volunteers will take your pledge over the phone now. We've been proud to stand with our community here in Austin and provide the information and resources our listeners have needed to help them weather the uncertainties of the pandemic this past year. Your financial support during this membership drive will help sustain our station operations, but it is your act of giving that is the encouragement that sustains the many volunteers at Co-op and provides us the assurances that you value Co-op and what we provide this community. Your support means Co-op will continue to stand with its community, and we will face whatever uncertainties may come in the coming months together. Thank you so much for your generous spirit. We couldn't do this without all of you. Now let's get back to our conversation with Kim Jones, editor of the Austin Chronicle.
We've got just a few minutes left here. I wanted to talk about some of your own columns. So you've got a weekly column, and I think you just started that earlier this year, right? Or at the end of last year, We Have an Issue. Is that the name?
Yeah, we did a print redesign in, gosh, I think it was February. And I just started doing, it's really just sort of an editor's introduction to the issue. It's not huge, but I've been an editor for, I don't know, 3 years, 4 years now. And I just kind of, I was ready to have a place to have a little bit of a voice in the issue. So
a couple of them were really touching. I think Austin actually did the cover story 1 week about AA meetings online. Mm-hmm. And you talked a little about your own, what do we say, abstinence, or the fact that you stopped drinking a year ago.
Boy, great timing, right?
Just when the rest of us are, you know, streaming into Twin Liquors and Specs, you know.
Right. Yeah, and that's something, you know, I've only been writing this column for, I guess, about 8 months now. And it's every column for me is kind of I wanted to do the column in general to be more transparent about who works at the paper and what we think about when we put our stories together, and just have our readers really get to know us better. And so sometimes I wonder, I don't know, am I revealing too much of myself? But, you know, Austin did a terrific cover story about what it's like for people who are in recovery, trying to keep their sobriety virtually during the pandemic. And it just seems like, you know, obviously it's something I'd been thinking about. Well, I decided to quit drinking. It's been over a year now, but it just felt like the right time for me to talk about how it was a really positive decision for me. I never went into recovery or did AA or anything. It was, like I said in the piece, it was just, I just knew I was done, and I knew that I really should have been done a lot sooner. For me, a big part of what we do at the Chronicle is just kind of letting people know that they're not alone. And I just kind of thought, well, if I write about how I'm doing, maybe that will resonate with someone else. Of just, I think knowing that you're not alone, especially when we are all intensely isolated right now, I think is another part of what our mission is. So, and a lot of people have reached out to me about that column in particular. So I guess, you know, a lot of us are in the same boat.
Well, I'll tell you, the other one that I shared with dozens of friends was the one where you talked about not putting your life on hold until we get back to quote unquote normal. I don't know what inspired that, but it was incredibly touching. You know, it was really a call to action to live in the present, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
I figure if I'm feeling a certain way, a lot of other people are feeling it too. And yeah, it'd been so many months of just feeling like I was stuck in place, and that I was, that this was something to just barrel through. You know, I've mentioned this to you, Bob, that pretty much right as the pandemic was happening, a family member got a cancer diagnosis, and not one of the good cancers. Yeah. So that's, for me, has been my experience throughout this entire pandemic, is that it's sort of, well, there's this one catastrophe, and then there's other catastrophe over here. And I was having the same sort of feeling of like, we just got to get through this. We just got to push through this. And I just sort of came to this, you know, clarity of like, no, we're going to, I mean, yes, I want to get on the other side of it, but I really need to be in the moment of what is happening right now and really appreciating everything that is happening right now, good and bad. Just, I think I said in the column, it's just like, we're not just putting ourselves up on a shelf for 6 months or a year or 18 months or however long, because you'll go mad, you know? So yeah, I mean, and I do not want to give any, you know, I don't want people to think that I've figured anything out. It's day to day for me, like I'm sure everybody else. And I've done ridiculous rabbit hole. You know, I tried learning Icelandic for about 3 weeks. That was a fun. Yeah. So, you know, it's just, we're all just trying to figure out how to manage this thing. And, but if I've been able to give anybody any comfort, then that makes me feel terrific. So, yeah.
If you were learning Spanish, I'd greet you, or I'd say something, you know, silly in Spanish. But Icelandic, I won't even touch that.
Yeah, turns out Icelandic is really hard.
Well, just to wrap this up, let's think about going forward. You know, I'm hoping that the Austin Chronicle has a bright future, just as I hope the city of Austin does. But boy, there are days when I think about the reality of this town that is so dependent on entertainment and on tourism and conventions and whatnot. Boy, I don't know. Any thoughts about all that?
I don't. I mean, no good thoughts, unfortunately. Yeah. I mean, we're just, every week we're hearing of iconic businesses that are just not able to weather the storm. Yeah. And I think that in particular live music, but really any kind of performing art, and also our film theaters, which are pretty beloved to me. That's just, I think when we come out of, on the other end of this, it's going to be a really different Austin. And that's sort of, you know, something I think that this city is always grappling with, is this feeling of we're losing what Austin is, that ineffable Austin, whatever. You know, it's the joke that whatever day you move to Austin, the day after is when you start complaining that it's just not like it used to be. but yeah, I really worry I really worry what this town's going to look like when we get through this. Yeah. So I hope that people in whatever way they can will continue to support the businesses, the cultural institutions, their neighbors, anybody in any way that they can. It's just, you know, it's such a cliche, but like, we just got to be nice to each other. Yeah, there is so much ugliness that I feel like anything you can do to be kind and compassionate and support people in any way you can is what we all got to cling to right now.
Wow. Well, I'm inspired. I really appreciate that.
Oh, I just felt like it was a big bummer.
No, but it's from the heart. Every little bit of genuine heartfelt sentiment to me is just really touching. I can't tell you how many times I've just broken out in tears watching some sappy old TV show or talking to a friend and they say something, and I do appreciate that.
Well, again, Bob, we love Co-op. We've loved doing the show. I'm so eager to get back to doing the Austin Chronicle show with you, and we would not have been on Co-op without your support and encouragement and, like I said, your hand-holding. And I know we're wrapping it up here, but seriously, getting to do the show and learning how to do radio under your tutelage is literally one of the most fun things that I have done in the last couple of years. And it was so exciting to discover that I was learning something new and that I had new tricks up my sleeve. And like I said, can't wait to get back into the studio with you.
The sentiment is certainly mutual. Thank
you. You guys have a natural rapport, I must say. you need to be back on the air. We got to get you back on the air.
Well, I look forward to it.
All right, we'll call it there. Thanks so much for joining us today, working us into your schedule. I'm sure it's, if you're like us, you're probably working twice as hard just to keep things going, you know?
Everything takes twice as long to accomplish these days too. So,
sure.
But it was absolutely worth it to get to talk to you guys again. And yeah, again, thank you. Thank you for having me on and for being such a supporter of the Chronicle.
Okay. All right. Well, all good things to you, and hope we talk again soon. Okay.
Okay. Sounds good. You take care. It was good to meet you, Michelle.
Nice to meet you too. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Okay. Bye-bye.
We're speaking with folks from the Austin Chronicle this evening. A quick programming note, we're in the middle of Co-op's 2020 fall membership drive. Please show your support by going to our website, koop.org, and click on the donate button in the upper right corner. Or call us at 512-472-5667. We couldn't do this without you. 512-472-5667. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly, along with Michelle Manning Scott. On our website is a large button labeled Donate. Please do. We could not keep going without your support. You can also call us at 512-472-5667. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on September 9th and 10th. We're speaking with editors and writers for the Austin Chronicle. As I mentioned in the first half of the show, we've got Austin Sanders with us this evening. Austin has been a regular guest on this show, giving us updates about the salient events of the summer. Austin is a staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. Welcome back, Austin.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here for the membership drive.
You know, I was just thinking back. It was March 17th, and the mayor had just shut down the bars and the restaurants that day, and I managed to grab you, and we talked about that for a little bit, and, you know, just before we recorded here, we were chatting a little about how distant all that seems, and what another world, you know?
For maybe, you know, 4 weeks starting in early March, it was kind of a blur. Things were just kind of happening in succession. More cases were being reported and more shutdowns were happening. And it kind of seemed like, you know, all of us reporters were just watching our inbox for the latest press release from the city announcing that libraries would close or recreation centers. And then finally, kind of the big one was, as you mentioned, the bars and restaurants. That was a big deal when those establishments were finally closed. Felt like really a turning point locally and how we were kind of bracing for the spread of the coronavirus.
And we talked with Kim a little bit about what all had happened there at the Chronicle. You had a staff member who was diagnosed as positive, you know, what that did to the office situation there. I also mentioned that, you know, for about 3 weeks, co-op was essentially off the air. We were just playing music for 3 weeks solid and until we got our interim system going here. And I don't think any of us believed that we'd be doing this, recording our shows from home like this, as we have for 6 months now. When I came back on the air, you were one of the first guests that we had on there. I can't remember exactly the timing, but it was about that time. It would have been late April when Michael Ramos was shot. Next to the pandemic, I would put that event locally as one of the more significant events and was sort of an omen for what was to come for many months after that.
Yeah, it's interesting to think back that the shooting of Michael Ramos, the fatal shooting, which was April 26th, obviously that happened after all of the shutdowns and things were in place. But the killing of George Floyd just completely accelerated things, again, which is something that has kind of happened all over the country, where these police shootings are happening with regular occurrence. This national protest movement really took root all over the country in cities where police shootings have been happening and local activists have been, you know, speaking out against them and pushing for change. But the Floyd killing, which went national, really kind of changed things really for cities everywhere and activists pushing for justice reform everywhere.
It was very recent that we heard about Daniel Prude in Rochester. And, you know, it's like this stuff just keeps oozing out. How many more of these are out there, you know? How many more happened with nobody making a video of them, you know?
Totally. Yeah, that's been a big part of the problem. There is no national database of police shootings. It's taken newspapers. The Guardian and the Washington Post created their own databases to better track police violence. And yeah, that's certainly been a big issue. Another part is just police departments' kind of widespread reluctance to share information with media, with the public, when these kinds of incidents happen, as we've seen here in Austin with the Michael Ramos shooting. He was killed in late April, and it wasn't till, I want to say, sometime in July that the body cam video of the incident was finally released by the police department, even though the shooting was captured from multiple angles by bystanders on their cell phones. So the public had already a good idea of what happened in that tragic event, but the police didn't release their version for another couple of months, which, you know, just kind of adds to the frustration that many people feel after these terrible events happen.
AJC and other groups were calling for Brian Manley's resignation or termination as police chief. We don't hear as much about that at this point. I mean, there was so much more focus on the budget and the reduction of APD's portion. Do you think that that just eclipsed the call for Manley's resignation, or have you heard anything recently?
It was just kind of the way the activist community felt they needed to invest their energy and their resources, not as much in advocating for the police chief to be removed from his job, which, you know, has all kinds of legal complications that don't make it as simple as the city manager firing him. Obviously, the city council can't do it. So there's all these complications, but they saw an opportunity to achieve reform that advocates have really been building for the past several years in budget cycles and budget debates, in decreasing the amount of funding that is allocated for the police department. They saw a real opportunity to achieve that goal that they've been pushing for with, you know, not much success, at least compared to what was achieved in this budget. It was kind of agreed that that would be the focus, although no one I talked to has ever indicated that they feel like Brian Manley is the right person for this job. You know, there's still a desire to have him replaced as police chief. You know, I would expect to see renewed focus now that the budget is established. However, there's now this process that, you know, is being called reimagining public safety, that's involving advocates and activists and city staff and police department officials and police oversight officials, where they're going to figure out how they can continue to reduce the police department's budget and shift resources and things of that nature, which is going to be intensive work. But the main thing that I hear from city council members who have been vocal in calling for Manley to resign and activists alike is that work is not going to be successful with someone like Brian Manley leading the police department. And really, that dissatisfaction with Manley goes back well before even the shooting of Michael Ramos. It goes back to really his appointment as chief, but there was, you know, some disagreements over how the police department responded to council loosening restrictions on where people experiencing homelessness can camp and sleep in the city. Many activists and some on council felt that the police department was not as cooperative as they could be, not as supportive of the council as they could have been, and what the council voiced clearly was an important priority in decriminalizing homelessness. And then really in a vote council took in January to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana, the very next day after council took that vote, Chief Manley held a press conference in which he told reporters, basically, we're not changing anything. Council says that we shouldn't arrest people or cite people for this. It's still a law in the state of Texas and that you can't possess, you know, marijuana. And we will cite people and arrest people as we see fit. And I think that was a really stark example for people in the justice community and on council that Brian Manley was not maybe as interested in progressive police reform, criminal justice reform, as some initially thought when he was appointed permanent chief. So yeah, this is something that's been building for quite some time.
Now, has his position changed since January?
That's true, yes. First, there was ordered to not spend any money or resources on lab equipment, which would be able to test a substance to determine if it was marijuana or an illegal form of marijuana. And so he didn't do that. And then it was, I think maybe in July or June, he sent a memo to council and city staff basically saying, we are going to stop arresting or citing people for these offenses. So it took him 5 or 6 months to get there when, right, you know, many activists and some on council would say he could have done that the Friday after council voted. He could have come out and said, I understand this is council's will and I'm working to meet it, to fulfill the law, but also honor what a council is setting as a policy and priority for the city.
In the meantime, here we are today with, I guess there's a couple of billboards on I-35 when you're entering Austin. Have you seen those?
I've seen image of them, yeah. Governor Greg Abbott has gotten involved in the city's decision to reduce the police department's budget, which really they reduced it by about 5%, $20 million right, of a $434 million budget. Of course, they have plans to reduce more, but even some of those reductions are not cuts. Something like taking the forensics lab, the DNA evidence lab, which we've talked about on your show, they're not talking about eliminating that. They just want to take it out of the police department and maybe create an independent body that oversees the lab or something where a different department would oversee its function. So even that's not really cutting the police department budget necessarily. Right. Still, it's certainly been a political piece that Republicans all over the state, including Governor Abbott, are taking advantage of to misrepresent, mischaracterize what the council did as a threat to public safety. In fact, as we're speaking today, the governor is holding a press conference where he's asking all elected officials in Texas to sign, which says that I will never seek to decrease a police department's budget, which is just, you know, absurd political theater is what he's doing. It's a non-issue. I mean, frankly, it's not a realistic thing to expect politicians to adhere to such a pledge. It's something that the governor can use to kind of rally the Republican base.
It was pretty clear that they were targeted at the city of Austin, you know, given that they're both near the city limits.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's just switch perspective just a little bit here. You're a native Austinite, so you grew up here and you've got a feel for this city that I sure don't have. I'm just curious, you know, if you've reflected all about what you've seen during the past 6 months. You know, what does it mean? Does it give you hope? What do you think it means for the future? Any thoughts about all that?
I think what we've seen really since what's been happening since 2014, when the first 10-1 city council districts were elected, we've begun to see a shift in power within the city away from wealthier and frankly whiter people in the city who historically have held the most power. And certainly many would argue with good reason that that class of people still holds more power. But we've certainly seen a shift since 2014. And I think really in the past 6 months, especially when it comes to conversations over public safety, we've begun to see that power shift more. You know, my news editor, Michael Clark Madison, who has lived in Austin for 30 years and has written about our politics for, you know, most of that time, observed to me while we were talking about police budget cuts, when he was writing about the police department in the 90s and 2000s, he would ask officials, "We're a relatively safe city. Why don't we decrease spending on police and invest in other services?" He would just get like blank stares, like as if to say, "Are you serious? What are you thinking? We would never do that." So the fact that we have done that as a city, citizens rallied behind city council members pushing for this change. There were several meetings where there was hours and hours of testimony of people calling and demanding for this change. It reflects a shift in power, I think. You know, not enough to achieve the other policy initiatives that need to be made to create real racial and class equity, but there's certainly a shift afoot. And it's frankly been inspiring, you know, to see some people, activists and others who have been pushing for these kinds of changes for years and decades in some cases, to kind of have the fruits of that labor pay off. So I think that's kind of the thing that's really sticking in my mind, is the kind of power shift that we're living through that's kind of unfolding within the city.
We talked about this with Kim too, that, you know, I think we all want to be hopeful, but we shouldn't kid ourselves either. I think the road to recovery for Austin is going to be a difficult one when you think about the fact that so much of the city's income depends on tourism and conventions and entertainment. All of that's just been really devastated, you know?
Right. We don't really know when that will return. You know, there's a question of, okay, I think everyone kind of looks at the development and delivery of a vaccine as kind of a turning point in confronting the virus. But will people really feel comfortable at that point going to conventions and crowded spaces the way that we used to do before March? It's really hard to say at this point. It's kind of a bleak future when even, you know, what's really going to save us from this virus, we're uncertain when that's going to come, what delivery is going to look like, and if people will actually be comfortable returning to their old lifestyles after the vaccine is widespread. The city has been doing, you know, what they can to help people, and they have two programs which, you know, will soon be accepting applications or are accepting them now to provide financial relief. One is the rent program, Relief of Emergency Needs for Tenants is that acronym. And basically, that's a program to help people earning below 80% of the median family income in Austin, which I think is about $78,000 a year. They'll help you pay your rent, which, you know, it's been a big need for people. And then the RISE Fund, which we've talked about in previous shows, has been replenished with more money. And what they're doing with that this time is it's basically a direct cash payment through a bank transfer or a prepaid debit card. Families earning, I think this one is 200% of the poverty line, you can apply for this program and get this direct cash assistance, which you can use, you know, for anything. So I wrote about these programs in the Chronicle. You can find it in the print issue or online, austinchronicle.com. I have more details on when and how to apply, the dates and deadlines and things like that. I would really encourage listeners who may need that assistance or know of others who need that assistance to check out our website for more information.
Well, we really appreciate you joining us all these weeks and hope it'll continue. It's been a great service to our listeners, to Co-op Radio. Thanks so much Sure. for your reporting on this.
And, yeah, thanks. I appreciate it.
We're in our fall membership drive at Co-op, thinking about the Austin Chronicle, thinking about Co-op, you know, how we both serve. I don't know what portion of the population, but whatever it is, I think we both do it well in our own ways. This has been a great little partnership with you and with Kim and the Austin Chronicle show. Hopefully we'll get that going again soon too. Again, thanks so much.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to picking up the Chronicle show as well. And yeah, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Hey everybody, Art Baker from Jamaican Gold here. If you're anything like me, the last 6 months have been awful. I mean in all capital letters, awful. But a truly bright spot for me during all of this has been how Co-op Radio has risen to the challenge. We created an all-new broadcast pipeline from scratch, on the fly, in the middle of a pandemic. It took an immense amount of ingenuity, effort, and even some arcane incantations that I will not share with you here. I'm so proud of how our crew has stood up and met these challenges. Now, I'm asking you to stand up with us by showing your financial support. Please take a moment and visit koop.org to donate now. Together, we truly do make a difference.
And you can also call us at 512-472-5667. That's 512-472-COOP. So we've got one more guest here from the Austin Chronicle who should be known to all of our listeners. Michael King is the former news editor of the Austin Chronicle, recently retired, although every once in a while, if you look carefully, you'll see something that he wrote. Great to have you here, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for asking, Bob. I'm glad to take part.
How's retirement been treating you?
Well, strangely, as everybody else, I mean, when I decided to retire at 70, I hadn't expected the entire world to retire with me. It's been hard for me to establish a rhythm. I've done a little bit of writing for the Chronicle and other places. I was covering some of the primary races and the ongoing vote by mail story. And the other part of me worries that, you know, we're in a permanent crisis and what little bit I can contribute to try to fend that off, I should be doing. So I've been kind of not very successfully juggling retirement, freelance, and house painting.
It's been an incredible year, you know, when you think about it. I mean, starting off with the pandemic and then just moving into all this social unrest, maybe upheaval, and then, you know, watching our own city's reaction. What's your take on all this?
Whether it can sustain itself is uncertain. I mean, we periodically have these uproars and then people are yearning for business as usual. It's unusual in this case in that the country is so polarized and everything, the primary focus is on the fall election and, you know, a lot of worry and concern and every day some new revelation. Here in Austin, you've got the city-state polarization, sometimes rhetorical battles over what should be done about police. I don't think anybody quarrels with the notion that, in the broad sense, that we need a different form of policing and incarceration than we have now. How we get from A to B is a whole another matter. And unfortunately, because politics are so polarized, it becomes a rhetorical battle more than an actual one. We've got a rogue political party in charge of the state and in charge of the country, and it's unclear where we can move them.
It's interesting to me that this story that broke last week in The Atlantic about the suckers and losers in the military, how that seemed to have legs.
The suckers and losers story was in part an insider betrayal story, in that Goldberg sources clearly see Trump as a danger. They don't want to speak publicly on their own, so they use a journalist. I'm familiar with that syndrome, especially with public officials. They use a journalist to say things that they don't want to say in public. The problem is that his core 40% doesn't seem to care what he does. He's their champion. Whatever he says is fine with them. And more specifically, he's upholding the white supremacist caste system. That's his main job. That's what all this screaming about the suburbs is about, and all of this screaming about law and disorder in the cities. It's maintaining the color line. I don't think it can work. It won't work with the majority of the people, but it works with close to 40% of the people.
It's been incredible to watch that over the years. It finally dawned on a lot of us, you know, how long it took for us to wake up and realize that he was pretty invincible politically, at least with that base of his.
You know, I confess to some surprise. I was really scared in 2016, even when people were telling me he can't win. I wanted to believe that, but I was terrified. I've talked to enough people as a reporter to know that there are a lot of people in this country who are revanchist, who are racist, who see the Democratic Party as simply the party of people of color, but they're not that polite. But I thought it was about 20% of the people. I was surprised that 40% of the people either are outright racists or don't see that as disqualifying. And it's frightening that 4 years of that have not made much of a dent. If we didn't have the Electoral College, I would be a lot less worried. I think there's no way he could win the popular vote this time because he didn't win it the last time. But if he gets enough states to flip, and you even still have knuckleheads on the left saying, oh, they're all the same, which is astounding to me. I guess I shouldn't be surprised at that because I've seen that all my life as well. And so, you know, it's frightening. And right down the line, I mean, Texas is kind of a bellwether because it's very close here, which it hasn't been that close. Even though he won big here the last time, apparently his poll numbers are really tight with Biden this time around. One comforting thing is it looks like the Democrats will take over the House. I don't see how the Republicans can stop that, the Texas House. That will hold off some of the worst stuff, especially in redistricting. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how long we can wait, for example, before we have a coherent climate change project. That's what's devastating California today. It's clear we can't go very much longer with a coherent pandemic project. And we're not going to get that out of this administration. And whatever else happens, he's going to be there at least till January. He may try to announce a vaccine next month, but all the scientific and medical signs are that there's no such animal available. So
the lightning and thunder that was hitting your place seems to be hitting mine right now. We're recording this on Wednesday afternoon. I'm wondering if this is, again, some sort of an omen here for the discussion that we're having.
any Texan who's unhappy with summer rain, I guess, has not lived here long enough. You asked about the local situation. You know, it's difficult to see exactly what's going to come out of all of this movement. I'm really concerned, for example, that simply because of the pandemic and the accompanying economic crisis, that voters are going to be reluctant once again to vote for Project Connect and for a real mass transit program, simply because they'll balk at the cost. It's not going to get any cheaper, and we desperately need it, but I think people are going to look at it and be real nervous. The fact that it is a presidential election, which means a much higher turnout, works in its favor. Whether that'll be enough, I don't know. I've been really discouraged by the transportation votes over the years. Suburban voters basically saying all they want is highways. That really devastates the city.
On that note, I think we're going to wrap this up. Kim and I were talking about where all this is headed. It's going to be a tough recovery for the city, no matter which way you slice this, you know. This city has been so dependent, and certainly in recent years, on tourism and conventions, entertainment and arts. It's going to be a tough recovery from that, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly hope little institutions like Co-op can survive and prosper, because it's a lifeline, and a lifeline not only, say, for discussions like this, but for the music community and so on. We cannot get our economy back until we control this virus, and I don't see any substantial prospect of that happening before the end of the year when a vaccine becomes available. So we'll see.
Well, really appreciate your joining us here today for our fall membership drive. Would love to have you back on the show again sometime soon. Austin Sanders has been doing a great job keeping us appraised of all the budget developments and protests and the APD stuff. So
seriously, I'd be glad to talk with you when it's possible. Okay.
I hope we can all be back in the studio soon.
That would be really nice.
Out of time here. Go to koop.org, click the donate button, or call us at 512-472-5667. Take care, everyone. Stay safe.